All right. So this is, I guess it's not a round table at the end. It's more of like a half moon.
Yes, it is.
We're working the celestial. So it's really just a space for us to sort of, you know, keep on talking. And we're not going to be finished talking by any means. In fact, in some sense, the symposium starts officially at 4 o'clock when we leave this building, right? This is about a spur, right? And at Dixon Place, we're all going to Dixon Place afterwards, and over drinking conversation will continue. But let's open it up, both for conversation among the speakers, but also with you. And I know that, actually, I'm going to call you out in the second row. You had your hand up at the end of the last panel. Would you like to ask your question or make your comment here? I'm sure I've just put you on the spot, but that's the moderator's prerogative. Thank you.
I was just thinking that yesterday there was a lot of space given to the idea of the kind of individual being able to feel differently, I guess, and the importance of giving voice to that possibility and the role that plays in those individuals' lives. And today there was more of a focus, or at least I was interested in a focus, on the possibility of kind of that happening, but in the context of community, and whether it was called the commons or whether it was, I guess it was called a bunch of different things. And Heather, you talked about affectivity not just being an individual thing, but something that can be, that is collective or in the commons or however you want to call it. And I was just hoping to hear either from you or from anyone else more about that, particularly about how affect could be conceived of not just an individual phenomenon, but a collective one.
I mean, I'm really just building on the work of a lot of people in affect studies who I think have used affect to say that it's, you know, that affect has nothing to do with the individual would obviously be kind of like to really sort of perverse in a certain way to overstate the case. So, but that, you know, affect is a way of kind of talking about the ways that people are, you know, interdependent before they're individuals, or to think about sort of, you know, the transmission of affect and kind of things like atmosphere and mood, right, that are sort of clearly ways in which, you know, we're not just like putting emotions, you know, out expressively from ourselves, but also living kind of in common with others. So there's just been a lot of interesting work on that, and I think it's a good model for, I guess, getting at questions of, you know, something that I think came up so much in our panel and that I think would be interesting to talk about more, which would be like the body, you know, as a kind of like locus for individual experience, but putting that, putting the individual kind of in connection with others and also in connection with like, you know, larger social structures.
Can I add something? Because that's one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot with the with this project in general, and of course with the formulation of this title, and it is this who to me is actually not the individual. It's the formation of this collective entity that transcends the idea of identity politics and becomes the opportunity to build, say, a politic of solidarity with other groups that are not necessarily gender or sexual minorities, if you will. So in that sense, the who to me is actually this larger collective information, or collectives information in plural, rather.
I mean, I think that's a great question. I really recognize what you're talking about. Yesterday, there were just wonderful discussions about kind of moments where our kind of maps of the sex gender system aren't enough, and we have to think about the particularity of certain people and how they inhabit their bodies, the world, either physically or emotionally differently. And I thought that was really interesting. And to sort of think then about those particularities and how they're all part of a plurality is what I'm interested in. So for me, you have to have, you have to spend time attending to those singularities, those instances are not otherwise articulated, but the purpose is to then imagine them as part of a plurality, you know, that is predicated on a kind of radical idea of difference.
One of the things I talked about briefly yesterday was the
desire that many queer people have not to leave behind our adolescent affiliations with groups of same-sex friends in order to pursue dreams of privatized pair bonding. And one of the things that's interesting about that for me is that in order to make that collective, what one must have is a series of individual choices.
I was really struck, Matthias, in your talk about, I think what you said was that the kind of campaign against queer studies like didn't marshal any evidence, and that it didn't hurt it, but maybe even in fact it like could do what it was doing because it didn't like make a case. And so I was thinking a little bit about, so this question is really for, I thought about it while I was listening to you, but it's for anybody, because then thinking about like the various archives that were being looked at today and these different relationships to history, I was thinking about like the difference between like evidence, proof, you know, and feeling maybe, or something else, and the ways that like, I mean, I think one way to think about the way that queer politics gets like absorbed into neoliberal projects is through its like a burden of proof, a kind of, it's a kind of thing that allows for like our understanding of violence to be reduced to like hate crimes that you can count and classify and then incarcerate around. And so so I was wondering if people could say some things about like what do we do with that sort of when we resist evidence with feeling, you know, what some of the possibilities, but maybe also limits of that might be.
I actually work with this a bit about what kind of evidence feeling is, particularly in a moment that I'm not quite sure what to make of yet, that is, I think, a fairly common experience, is being in an audience where people around you are having a collective response that you don't share, right? Like the moment when the whole house surges to their feet and you're like, eh, not so much. Or the other way around, which also happens. And in, especially when you're in, minoritarian defined arts venues where the crowd is self-selected as likely to respond effectively to similar material, such moments of feeling differently are actually, I think, very important gates into thinking about how the desire to be a we can sometimes supersede people's critical capacity. And also how sometimes that moment where people do surge forward in a collective or allow themselves to be carried along with that, what I'm trying to work on a little bit is how can we come up with a way of getting, of using such moments for critical leverage instead of simply saying, oh, that is an uncritical crowd response. That may be, but that doesn't mean it isn't, that it could not be useful if put to some purpose that I can't quite get at yet. So I know that other people have had this experience and lots of people are nodding. So I'm kind of hoping that someone will tell me what to say next. Any thoughts? What does that moment mean? And what can we do with it?
Well, maybe you can respond to that.
I have kind of another direction, so maybe you should go first.
I'm also having a bit different direction, I think, even though I think we should come back to your question. Like, just the funny thing about the whole case in Norway, just to say just two words about that more hard facts talk, it was that queer theory does not have any interest in the empirical. And what I tried to do in the Norwegian debate in Norway was just kind of to ask these different critics, well, I would just really like to have like one, you know, just one reference to who actually says these things. Like, because you're really interested in that queer theory does not understand the empirical, but can we have at least one empirical example of that lacking empiricism? I got no replies at all. Nobody. I just got, we do not want to reply to your article. And of course, I didn't get like a lot of text I wrote. I never even made it to the papers because they didn't want to print it. I think it is crucial, or here at least I'm inspired by other people in the panel, like Jose's work on ephemeris evidence and invisible evidence of queerness, and to also deal with that kind of ideology of hard facts, and to really, really be critical to that. And I think affect opens up a space for thinking both critically about what kind of evidence the evidence of experience, as Joan Scott has criticized in important, though also problematic ways. Sitting at the problem of evidence, I guess, is interesting. And I think also your work, Patrick, on the arc, the body as archive and repertoire, and not either or, also opens up a space for really kind of rethinking what evidence can be, and always having that as a kind of a question.
Just to say about the sitting in the theater as a skeptical audience member, I mean, one of the things that I have really liked about Affect Studies is that it's, I think, made an effort to not be condescending about a lot of, like, you know, popular forms of feeling, mass affects, audience reception, and so on. And so maybe you think it doesn't succeed, but I've been attracted to that aspect of that project, and I think there's a lot of potential there for just, I mean, I feel like, you know, sort of Affect Studies came along, and what it showed me was that I... basically wanted to kind of like devote my scholarly practice to like trying to work back against a false consciousness argument, like as, and just to take that as far as that could possibly go, definitely at the risk of being like uncritical or insufficiently critical. So, you know, you'll find me like being like, actually, you know, it gets better despite everything. Like, you know, it's not just rescuing the utopian kernel. It's like, no, what actual work is this doing in the world, and how can we think about it in ways that really resist that kind of condescension, which is so fundamental to, you know, not just our intellectual history, but to our social location. And that's, you know, so, you know, the kind of, like, where are we in the world is, like, I think very, very important. I guess this goes to the institutional and professional question. I have something else I want to say about empiricism and facts, but maybe I think other people want to jump in on this thread, maybe.
I have a short little thread, which is just I want to say that... to think about the evidentiary, and you posit in one way and people are answering different ways, but it also provoked in me a question of self-censorship, which I think is a huge concern in our community, you know, I mean, like, and it also, again, brought me back to your great question about sort of asserting like a non-presence or something, but I just wanted to throw that. You can go again.
Just one like little thing about this. I really do want to just, I think Matthias's point about the relationship of articulation to disarticulation is very, very salient, because I think as soon as something is articulated, it's almost automatically disarticulated, right? The translation and performance would be old Kiki and Herb shows where Justin's refrain was, and the backlash always comes, right? But the backlash is immediate, because there are always people who, you know, who are the people who announced the death of queer studies recently, the death of black studies, right, in relationship to Northwestern, with that scandal with the Chronicle of Higher Education, there are always people who never wanted it to be alive anyway. So. That's the scenario when any of these things get articulated as dead. It's always about people who were never for them being alive anyway, and that's just an important kind of point to bring up.
Can I ask a question regarding this? I want to ask a question to both of you, Norwegians, because it seems to me that there is a pragmatism that we are not taking into consideration, which is the the legislative advancement of Norwegian society. And to me, it seems like only a society in which there is 100% sexual citizenship, right, in which the questions of adoption, marriage, and all of these things are something of the past, could pronounce queer theory dead. Not a place in which the legislative battle is so adamant and kind of just beginning. So in a sense, I wonder, you know, how do you relate to the pragmatism and the brilliance of the political strategy of the bureaucrats in making the law take place, and at the same time try to find an identity that defies that the normalization of that strategy.
You know, I'm constantly inspired by my clients, and they come to me because they don't feel well. They don't feel well with the political system. They don't feel well with themselves. And to me, to be here is kind of strange, because it's like moving in a landscape that is not quite familiar for me. the strange thing is, and this is a little critical, that none of my clients speak about queer theory. Maybe because it's not useful for them. And that is interesting because it's useful for me to visit this forest of thinking. And, well, large trees with big trunks. So, and a lot has happened in Norway. Many things are very good in Norway. I mean, we have you don't have to pay much to have your SRS or whatever you want to have. But you may want to have it, and still you will not get it, because there is in Norway, as of today, it's a lot of things are good, but a lot of things are very, very bad. And the bad thing is that the legislation has come far, but the healthcare system has got very short. And that's where I am. That's where my clients are struggling. That's where they find their happiness, unhappiness. That's where they have their affections and their sorrows and their shame and all that. And seeing it that way is a very long way to go. And I would like to quote also Tiger, who is not here anymore. Tiger is intersexed. And he says something that I can really also support, is that the most important thing is for the unusual people to present in Norway and here. And the challenge for you all is to receive that which is being presented. And maybe we can create some kind of we are human beings, and we are very different and very much alike. I don't know if I answered your question, but that's what came out to me.
Yeah, just kind of short follow-up on that. I guess I'm skeptical to that story implied in your question that we have 100% sexual citizenship in Norway already. Of course, because who are we who have that? There is certain, like, first of all, of course, as we talked about yesterday, for trans people and intersex people, no, that's not, like, we don't not have that those rights even in the so-called perfect Norway. But also, of course, who is recognized as a citizen of Norway? I think a lot of the point that I'm not interested in, like, saving queer theory as such. What I'm interested in is, or, like, my interest is in how to have a critical dialogue about questions of how sex, gender, and race does a lot of things in the political community and society. And I think what is disarticulated or neglected is that there are all these citizens who live in Norway who are not necessarily recognized as proper citizens. And that the whole legislation. The whole discourse of that and is also, like, it's formulated often that some people are folded into the Norwegian nation, but then others have to be excluded from that nation. And that that kind of folding in and exclusion is really racialized, and it's really going on through some particular subjects who are not, like, recognized as a threat to others. So I think there is really something to be said about that. Plus, we have such a right-wing movement in Norway, so, like, even the laws that we have won, if you want to stick to that language, you never know how long they will last. You know, if the People's Party, the right-wing People's Party, get into government now in a couple of years again, like, they have gone to, they're fighting to withdraw the marriage law, you know, to take away adoption laws. So, of course, like, these things are, like, these things are not secure or won, or I think that's danger. I think that's where repetition is interesting to think about stickiness of injustice, about these other kind of temporalities, about duration, saying things again and again, because, as Sharon Hayes does, because in the near future, you know, it might actually be relevant again. So, yeah.
What I think Norway can be used for is Norway is very transparent. Because we're about 5 million people, we have the best statistics in the world. You can find statistics for anything, and that's useful, you know.
Yeah. But there are bad questions in a lot of them.
Of course, but still, it is transparent, and I think it when things change, you will know that they change. I think when things change here, they may change in Soho, you know. Not necessarily anywhere else. So I think it was President Roosevelt who once said that you can look upon Norway as a social democratic workshop, and I think today it is a human workshop in many ways that we can learn something from. And I like to live there, even though I'm queer.
I moved.
Maybe just on the statistics question, I could just try to take one more shot at answering Craig's question, because it seems like the whole status of empiricism and facts is really interesting, and I definitely don't want to take the side of these fools who are talking about, you know, the death of queer theory. But I think it's true that they're sort of tracking a kind of turn from like postmodernism to like some kind of new empiricism, which, you know, I actually think comes up in our interest in the archive, right? We actually care about facts. You know, Patrick is kind of working between textual interpretation traditions and anthropological traditions, right? And even I was thinking about Emily talking about plasticity, right, which really comes out of kind of like, you know, neuroscience basically as a concept, right? So where, you know, what's the place of body and the facts? And I think in a sense, you know, I think the queer tradition, you know, as we understand it in queer theory, has been very anti-empiricist, coming out of psychoanalysis and literary criticism, deconstruction, and so on. But, you know, there's a lot of other traditions for thinking about sexuality. Anthropology would be, you know, a big one that actually, I think, give us a kind of more capacious way to think about possibly like a sort of queer empiricism. And I think that was already coming out in our panel, actually, in interesting ways. So.
Just add that I find in Craig's question actually a really profound political challenge for those of us who do affect studies, but and also when I say those of us who do, I think one does it in artistic forms, one does it in scholarly work. So, there, you know, when we, what do we do with sort of when we want to, when we talk about sort of let's think about affect and the world affect makes great, but it risks being an empty slogan or a dangerous slogan because we also live in a political moment. And I'll speak of the United States, where facts, basically feelings have become facts. They've been made facts. We went to war in Iraq based upon, you know, sort of a feeling in someone's gut. Yes, there are more things involved, but a lot of it was about the production of public feelings, the use of sentiment in the wake of 9/11. And so when Stephen Colbert, you know, came up with the word truthiness, he was describing something actually empirically true in the world about the ways in which feelings were being used. So can we actually just fight feelings with feelings? How adequate would that be? How do we retain a sense of history? And even as we're skeptical about which forms of history, what kind of evidence count as facts? And I mean, again, and I don't think there's a settled answer to that, but I think that the question you ask is actually a deeply profound one for us to contemplate both politically and ethically.
That also just made me think about, you know, what you're saying as far as what counts and the fact that, you know, Carlos is documenting all of this symposium, and it's important to us, and that's one type of documentation. But I think it's also important to remember the trace of someone's hand on your shoulder later, and that's another type of documentation that walks out of the room. So I think those two types of evidence that are happening, even as we all sit here together, are, you know, a really interesting way to take up this challenge that you've posed.
So you'll get the last word, and then we'll have a teeny wrap-up. So no pressure or anything.
Sorry, Anne, you're not going to have time for a wrap-up. We really have to be out of here in 10 minutes. I'm sorry. But first.
You probably all read the same New Yorker article I did where the Lawrence versus Texas case, which made sodomy permissible, was founded on this, was argued around this idea that there's love between these men, and so they should be able to have anal sex together. And which, of course, was not related to the facts of the case in any way. But it was an example of the way, and this sort of goes back to why I was doing this kind of pro-marriage argument last night, that there is actually a lot of precarity, I guess is a popular term right now, around the moment when queer affections actually have to interface with the law and trying to accommodate either side of that. And so, you know, gay love actually does, it's the fear of the right for a reason, you know, it actually does destabilize their system.
So, we are now adjourning to go to Dixon Place, 161A Christie Street. Huge thanks, shout outs now to Carlos and Reagan for curating this gorgeous conversation over these last 2 days, to the New Museum for hosting. And a 30-second wrap-up. Here's what we've learned. We've been offered a dose of wishful thinking, salted with indignation, which welcomes despair, and it's propelled by hope and the urgency of perpetual states of emergency. The final slogan borrowed from ecstatic resistance would be, just because it's impossible is no reason not to do it. Fail boldly. Fail again. Let's go drink.
And. One second. Just as initiator of this project, I want to thank everyone. This was really incredible. Thank and you. Also invite you, this project is happening in different stages. Almost every Thursday until September, there will be programs. Jared Gilbert, who is somewhere in the audience, will be conducting a program on queer and feminist theologies. Queerocracy will be doing a workshop on AIDS activism today. Gina, Janine Tang, and Rina Gossett will be doing some screenings and speaking about transgender issues in contemporary art. Please visit the website and come back. And if anybody has a program that they would like to propose to us, please come to me. Thank you.
And one more thing. The Thursday programs are taking place on Thursday evenings because Thursday evenings are free at the New Museum. And pardon? Where the exhibition is. They'll be taking place in the gallery, in the exhibition itself, which is in the Museum's hub on the fifth floor. This is kind of sounds so stupid. Well, two things. One, I mentioned before, some of you are still outside, that we do have Shape of the Right Statement by Wu Sang, who Jose showed the film Wildness of, but there's a very short video called Shape of the Right Statement from 2008 on view only through tomorrow on the fifth floor. It's 5.5 minutes long. If you want to go up and see that, come see me. I'll give you a ticket to go into the galleries. That is also that's on the fifth floor. The fifth floor is also the location of gender neutral bathrooms. If you need a ticket to go to the fifth floor, also please see me.
Thank you, everyone.